Russia withdraws some of its troops deployed near the Ukraine border despite a U.S. assertion of an imminent war. President Putin says Moscow doesn't want a war in Europe. Tehran says Washington's non-compliance with its obligations is the main threat to any agreement in the Vienna talks. People in Afghanistan take to the streets of the capital Kabul to denounce U.S. decision to seize half of their country's frozen funds there. This is World News from Tehran. I'm Behruz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. A baseless hysteria, that's how Moscow has described the West's allegation regarding an imminent Russian attack on neighboring Ukraine.
It is just ostensible baseless hysteria. Of course, if besides this hysteria and window dressing, media campaigns would be shown the real instinctive desire to discuss each other's concerns, the environment in Europe would be different. And this is exactly what President Putin is proposing to do.
The accusation by the U.S. and its Western allies has raised tensions with Russia for weeks. On Tuesday, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz held talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Moscow about the tensions. Putin has stressed that his country is not after war in Europe.
Do we want this or not? Of course not. That is exactly why we put forward proposals for a process of negotiations.
Putin also stressed that no country is allowed to protect its security at the cost of the security of others. He said his country is prepared to continue dialogue on missiles and other security issues with the West. However, he noted that Russia has received no constructive response from the U.S. and NATO to its demands. Moscow is seeking security guarantees in the face of NATO's eastward expansion, including a permanent ban on Ukraine's entry into the military bloc. Meantime, Russia has transferred some of its troops deployed near Ukraine back to their bases. Now, the Russian declaration that it's withdrawing some troops from the Ukraine border has met with cautious optimism in the West. NATO Secretary General says that Russia's announcement gives grounds for optimism, but the alliance has yet to see real de-escalation. The British Prime Minister is calling for the withdrawal of battalion tactical groups away from a potential theater of conflict. Germany's every real step toward de-escalation would be reason for hope. France says it has not yet verified the Russian claim, but if the information is correct, this will be a positive sign. Spain has also echoed the sentiment, saying that partial withdrawal would be excellent news if confirmed. Ukraine's foreign minister, meantime, voiced caution, saying that we believe what we see, not what we hear. Russia's parliament backs a resolution calling for diplomatic recognition of two areas held by Russia forces in eastern Ukraine as independent states. The motion is not binding and will be sent to President Vladimir Putin for feedback. It asked the president to formally recognize the self-proclaimed Luhansk and Donetsk republics, both located in Donbass region. On Tuesday, Putin said that people in the Russian Federation are very concerned about a situation in Donbass. He described the situation there as genocide and called for the conflict to be resolved. Meanwhile, the Western military alliance, NATO, has warned Moscow against recognizing Donetsk and Luhansk.
Well, if that happens, that will be a blatant violation of Ukraine's territorial integrity and sovereignty once again. Because there is no doubt that Donetsk and Luhansk is part of Ukraine within international recognized borders. So such a recognition will be a violation of international law and the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Ukraine. Not only that, it will also be a violation of the Minsk agreements.
The European Union has also said that any possible recognition of the two regions would be a clear violation of the Minsk agreements. Luhansk and Donetsk declared independence from Ukraine in 2014. Pro-Russian forces there have been fighting the Ukrainian army for almost 8 years. No country currently recognizes these regions as sovereigns. Another Ukrainian region, Crimea, rejoined Russia following a 2014 referendum. Now, Tehran is calling on the Western parties to the 2015 deal to take a realistic approach toward the Vienna talks. The Iranian foreign minister says in that case a good deal could be within reach. Hossein Amir Abdullahi made a comment in a tweet following a phone call with his British counterpart, Elizabeth Truss. This as Iran, the remaining signatories of the JCPOA, are engaged in intensive negotiations in Vienna to restore agreement left in limbo following the U.S. withdrawal in 2018. Iran's top security official, however, warned that a proven U.S. noncompliance is the most significant threat to any agreement. Ali Chamkhani says the verified removal of sanctions and guarantees, the two main demands set up by Iran, are the integral part of a good agreement. He has also repeatedly dismissed any outside interference in the Vienna talks among the JCPOA signatories. Israeli forces have killed one more Palestinian during a fresh rally in the occupied West Bank in support of the residents of the Flashpoint neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah in Al-Quds. The protests turned violent after regime forces opened fire on demonstrators. The alleged death brings to two the number of Palestinians killed in the past day. Violence also broke out in the Al-Quds University, where Israeli soldiers attacked a demonstration, leaving several people injured. 17 others were arrested. The situation remains tense in the entire occupied territories following recent attacks by Israeli forces and settlers in Sheikh Jarrah. Resistance movement Hamas has urged all Palestinians to mobilize in support of the neighborhood. Monai Kandel joined us a short time ago to give us the details on Israel's brutal tactic against the protests and support the residents of Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood.
A Palestinian was shot dead, and he had al-Barghouti, a Palestinian, a former Palestinian prisoner, was shot dead by the Israeli soldiers. He's originally from the village of Kufr Ain near Ramallah, and he was shot dead by the Israelis at the entrance to the village of al-Nabi Saleh. Now, the Israeli military issued a statement claiming that Palestinians there were protesting and they threw stones and rocks at the Israeli military checkpoint there. And then the Israeli forces responded by using live ammunition and live rounds against Palestinians, killing this Palestinian man. However, eyewitnesses said that he did nothing, was not among the people who were protesting or throwing rocks or stones. That's why we can say that it's an assassination. It's killing a Palestinian in cold blood, knowing that none of the Israeli soldiers would be prosecuted for committing crimes against Palestinians.
According to the United Nations, at least one-third of all Palestinian homes in East Al-Quds are facing demolition, and that would put more than 100,000 residents at risk of displacements. Observers believe that's part of a fresh drive by Israel to reinforce Jewish control over the whole city. Palestinian families have even been offered to remain in their properties, like in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, but as protected tenants, and even that coming with a condition that they should recognize Israeli ownership.
Israel's attempts to evict families from the Flashpoint Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood resulted in an 11-day war between Gaza-based Palestinian resistance groups and Israel back in May. Israel is evicting Palestinians to make way for its settlement-building activities. This is while, under international law, all Israeli settlements are deemed illegal. The United Nations Security Council has condemned Israel's activities in the occupied territories in several resolutions. Al-Quds remains at the heart of the decades-long conflict, with Palestinians insisting that East Al-Quds, fully occupied by Israel since 1967, must serve as the capital of a Palestinian state. In the meantime, the Al-Aqsa Mosque has had enormous significance throughout the years. In 2000, an Israeli official's visit to the holy site provoked a Palestinian uprising known as the Second Intifada. Observers believe any escalation of violence or provocative action by Israeli forces in the holy city could serve as a prelude to a new intifada.
It is part of the Judaization of East Jerusalem, and it's an attempt by Zionists to drive the Christian and Muslim area out of the city, increase the Jewish population.
Emboldened by former U.S. President Donald Trump's unqualified support, Tel Aviv expanded its illegal activities against the people of Palestine. Many were expecting a turn of events when Trump left office, but the regime continues to carry out its acts of aggression in the absence of any meaningful action from the international community.
The Israeli regime is also pushing ahead with a demolition of Palestinian homes, this time in Masafer Yatta, an area south of the West Bank. The area is located south of Al-Khalil, has seen a series of buildings knocked down in recent months. It's not known what exactly is causing the sudden increase in demolitions there, but the Israeli military frequently pulls down Palestinian structures in the occupied West Bank with the excuse that they lack construction permits. This is while the targeted buildings are often set up on grounds that have been owned by Palestinians for generations. Palestinians say the demolitions are part of the regime's expansionist policy and ethnic cleansing agenda. Okay, now it's time now for the news review. Let me start with the intro. People in Afghanistan are taking to the streets of the capital, Kabul, denouncing Washington's decision to seize half of their country's frozen funds in the U.S. On Friday, President Joe Biden signed an order to use $3.5 billion in frozen Afghan assets to compensate Americans impacted by the 9/11 attacks. The decision sparked outrage in Afghanistan that's reeling under immense food insecurity, poverty, and disease. Many Afghans criticized Biden's decision as an act of piracy. They have called on the international community to serve justice for them. Protesters also demand Washington compensate tens of thousands of Afghans killed during the U.S.-led war in the country over the past two decades. Washington's decision to seize Afghan funds comes as the country's economy is on the brink of collapse. Afghanistan relied heavily on international aid, but that too stopped once the Taliban rose to power in August last year. All right, to discuss that, I'm joined by Lawrence Davidson, former lecturer with Webster University, Westchester, and also Daniel Lazar, journalist and author, is joining me from New York. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Now, Professor Davidson, give me one good reason why the U.S. should not give this Afghan money back to the people who are in dire need. They are dying. They don't have food to eat. Half the population is impacted. They have no food to put on the table, and preventable diseases are just killing the people.
Well, I'm not sure if it's a good idea, but I'll tell you that the political situation, the domestic political situation here in the United States, this is not so much on Afghan poverty as on retribution, essentially, towards the Afghan governments that are associated, rightly or wrongly, with Osama bin Laden and the attacks on the United States. So when Afghanis think about their own economic situation, Americans tend to think about collapsing buildings in New York and in Washington. So you have a totally different perspective on this stuff. It's politically in Biden's favor to split these funds, even though it is a form of theft, okay? Nobody in America is going, except me maybe, is going to see it that way and a few others. Biden doesn't see it that way. So essentially, the American people do not see this situation like the Afghan people see it, just like the Americans have been taught not to see Iran like the Iranians see it. And the consequences of that is this form of theft. I would say that third world countries should think twice before investing in American bonds. I mean, that's what comes to my mind. Okay.
Okay. Now, let me ask you, Daniel, the reason why, as Professor Davidson says, Americans see things in the way that people in other countries see them. And Afghans are also human beings, right? And the U.S. just left. They pulled down its troops after decades, and in what situation? And they're only asking for their money, of course, on top of the compensation for the two decades of war and occupation.
Well, first of all, I think it's highly misleading to discuss how Americans see the situation in Afghanistan. I mean, the question is how the U.S. government sees it. And the U.S. government has not only been raining down destruction on Afghanistan since 1980, more than 40 years ago, when it armed the Mujahideen with the help of Saudi Arabia and sent them into battle against the then Afghan government. But the U.S. also, in blaming Afghanistan for 9/11, the destruction of the World Trade Center in 2001, covers up the far greater involvement by its chief, one of its chief allies in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia. And the U.S. covered up the Saudi role in 9/11. It blamed it entirely on the Taliban, whose role was actually far less than that of the Saudi royal family. And now it's continuing with its highly punitive and highly misleading policies. So I think the U.S. attitude towards Afghanistan has been purely punitive. It's rained down destruction on that country, and I think that laying the blame for Afghanistan, laying the blame for 9/11 on Afghanistan is part of that ongoing punitive process.
Okay. Thank you very much for your comments. Lawrence Davidson, former lecturer with Westchester University. Daniel Lazar, journalist and author in New York. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we discussed Imam Khomeini's advice on those clergy and quasi-clergy who are unaware of Islam but try to portray the capitalist and socialist economic models. In this episode, we're going to touch upon other parts of his testament in which he warns the clergy against being affected by rumors of those who are ill-wishers and enemies of the Islamic system. Stay tuned, please. When Imam Khomeini started his revolution in early 1960s, some of the ulema were opposed to him, even warned him of struggles against the regime of Shah. However, with the spread of the revolution, little by little, more ulema joined him. Nevertheless, a small number of these ulema continued opposing the Imam. During the first years after the victory of the Islamic Revolution and establishment of the new system of government, Iran faced myriads of internal and external problems. These included the moves of the remnants of the royal system, efforts of separatists to damage national unity through creation of riots here and there, and most importantly, the plots of external enemies to overthrow the system, or at least to fully render it inefficient. The all-out Iraqi war in 1980s was the climax of these plots. Imam Khomeini writes in his testament to those who kept finding fault with the Islamic system instead of helping it through giving solutions, "I recommend to those who, due to some mistakes, intentionally or unintentionally, are strongly opposed to the Islamic Republic itself, and for God's sake, are active to overthrow it, thinking that this republic is worse than or the same as the royal regime, just to ponder honestly in their solitude and fairly compare it with the former rule and regime. Besides, they should pay attention that chaos, mistakes, and opportunism are inevitable in revolutions in the world." Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, enumerates some problems facing the Islamic Republic system, such as the internal and external conspiracies, armed assaults, infiltration of corrupt elements in various government establishments, etc., and advises the ulema not to be deceived by media hype and rumors. He writes, "You should pay attention and consider the hardships of this republic, including plots, false propaganda, armed attack from outside and inside, inevitable infiltration of some corrupt groups and opponents of Islam in all government centers to make people discontent with Islam and the Islamic rule, being inexperienced of most or many of the authorities, spread of false rumors by those who have been denied or receive little illegitimate benefits, considerable shortage of judges and backbreaking economic problems, shortage of skilled and expert righteous people and scores of other problems, which one will be unaware of them unless being in the scene, in addition to those super capitalist persons who are proponents of the royal system and through usury, profiteering, immense overcharging, smuggling and hoarding, have pressured the destitute and deprived in the society to the extent of perishing and have been causing corruption in society. I humbly advise the respectable ulema not to be affected by these rumors and strengthen this republic for the sake of God and preservation of Islam." Thank you. Imam Khomeini advises those who are hell-bent on toppling the Islamic Republic system that once this system is toppled, the substitute will be a regime that will be the flunky of either the West or the East. He writes in his testament, "The respectable ulama should know that if this Islamic Republic fails, it won't be replaced by an Islamic regime which is intended by Imam Mahdi or one which is obedient to you. Either regime will be take power, which is intended by one of the poles of power, and the deprived of the world, who have enthusiastically turned toward Islam and the Islamic rule, will be disappointed and Islam will be isolated forever. And you will regret your acts when the die is cast, and there is no use in regretting. If you expect everything to change overnight, according to Islam and the laws of Almighty God, it is a mistake. Such a thing has not happened and will not happen throughout the human history. And on the day that, God willing, the absolute reformer, Imam Mahdi, will emerge, you should not think that there will be a miracle and the world will be reformed in one day. Rather, the oppressors will be suppressed and isolated through efforts and self-sacrifices."
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767. Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
He who asks questions cannot avoid the answers. A simple question.
Does it matter who owns English football clubs? Police are investigating a graphic banner displayed by Crystal Palace fans that targeted the Saudi Arabian takeover of Newcastle United. That banner focused on the Premier League's ownership test following Newcastle United's £305 million sale. It featured illustrations of a man dressed in Arabic clothing, alongside what appears to be chief executive of the Premier League, Richard Masters. The sign listed offences the regime is accused of by human rights groups: terrorism, beheading, civil rights abuses, murder, censorship and persecution, which were all ticked off on a clipboard under the heading Premier League Owners Test. The Premier League's chief executive, Richard Masters, was also depicted giving a thumbs up to a bag of cash, standing in a pool of blood. Palace fan group Homesdale Fanatics has said it created the banner, which was shown during a recent football match. An accompanying statement said, "To give the thumbs up to this deal at a time when the Premier League is promoting inclusive initiatives shows the total hypocrisy at play and demonstrates the league's soulless agenda where profits trump all." Although the Premier League said it had received legal assurances from the new owners that the Saudi state would not control Newcastle United and there would be penalties if this is not true, others doubt this to be the case. While the impact of these huge investments has been league success, for example for Manchester City, thanks to Abu Dhabi investment money, there are claims that these massive money ventures are designed to create a positive impact for the image of wealthy Middle East dictators. What does the public think of Saudi ownership of English football clubs? And why are these states so eager to buy British clubs in this way? Simple questions with important answers. And let's start with this. What does the public here in North London make of Saudi Arabia's human rights record? And do they even care? That's what we asked. Here's what they said.
I've not heard anything. I've heard of Saudi Arabia, but I know nothing about that.
I'm not an expert, but from what I've heard, at least on the women's rights side of things, it's pretty poor. It's pretty poor. Like, listening to the news, I think probably they're taking small steps to, I guess, like as a kind of show to like, oh, look, we're doing this, but in reality, it's like, it's not good.
To be honest, I don't actually know a lot about that. That's something that hasn't really come up on my radar. I haven't got a clue, to be honest. I really don't have anything to say about that.
I mean, the thing about Saudi Arabia is they obviously have made some changes, things like, you know, the last few years, women being able to drive, other things, but there's a lot that still continues to be sort of hidden and under the surface, and some of their arms deals, for example, with Yemen and other things, you know, there are clearly a lot of things going on, not all of which, I mean, most things don't make the news and most things aren't very public, so...
I just know that it's appalling. Yes, that's all.
I can't say I've ever actually thought about it. Maybe I should. And probably after this interview, I'll go on my phone and do some Googling.
Not a good record. I've supported Amnesty International for many years, written quite a few letters about Saudi Arabia's record on this subject. So, no.
I'm concerned about it. Because it's not very good, as I understand it. I don't know enough about it to go into detail, but... Yeah, so yes, I am concerned about it.
I think it's poor, and I think giving them the opportunity to use the Premier League to kind of wash it out is a bad thing.
I wouldn't say that I'm, you know, terribly knowledgeable about it, but I know that they have the death penalty, and not much else. I know that their sort of leader was accused in the murder of a journalist recently, and that's about all. I don't think they've got great rights for women. Would be my impression. But I'm not an expert on it at all.
No, at all. Yeah, it's not at all. Saudi Arabia is good country. It's Muslim country and it's good. And I don't know, I never heard any problem in Saudi Arabia. They're good, yeah.
I care about it because where I'm from as well, because I wasn't born here. So I'm in that part of the world where it's money talks, isn't it? That's all it is. It's just money. You know, I don't think they should be there anyway, to tell you the truth. You know, what should they?
What does the public think of Saudi-related state interests purchasing Newcastle United Football Club?
I mean, I think in general it's just sad how, you know, rich owners are just, you know, buying clubs. It feels like there's not really that closeness with fans anymore. You know, they're just they're different, just in a world of their own, just buying success. And yeah, I think that is sad. Yeah,
I mean, sometimes people say that sport shouldn't be political, but I think that's a, you know, they're making a quite a big statement. I think they've also owned quite a lot of other property and other things, don't they? It's not just the football club, various things that they own. And yeah, I don't really know what it's about, but I suppose it's having, you know, gaining influence in various different countries and making agreements in order to make better trade deals, and a lot of it's about arms as well. So yeah, it's not great.
I'm a huge football fan. I'm obviously a Gooner because of the area I live in. I kind of sort of disagree with the amount of money in football in general. I think it should be a bit more like fantasy football, where you have a certain amount of money that's capped and each team then has a set amount of money, because then it's fair. And then also the game is not about just the players, it's back about the sport. Whereas at the moment I feel like football is now just about how much money can one team spend on one player, and it becomes about an individual contest instead of the team sport. So I think, you know, I don't think there's a problem with like Saudi Arabia or other kind of countries buying up football, because it's a global sport and it kind of spreads awareness of the Premier League and stuff. But I sort of disagree with the whole money aspects of the sport, really.
I haven't got very strong feelings about it. I'm aware of it. I'm worried about, you know, a country like Saudi Arabia infiltrating our sport. But, you know, sport is business, is money, isn't it? I mean, football is capitalism with a capital C, really, isn't it? So, yeah, I mean, sad but true.
I think it's gross. Like, and I think if you look at the amount of dirty money that's in UK politics and UK sport, especially football, it's not a good thing.
I'm a football fan myself. It's a bit tragic how they bought Newcastle Football Club. Surely Newcastle fans will disagree with me. If they look at their track record, I think it's quite concerning.
Well, they have money. That's why they bought that, that big team. Yeah, that's good. That's good. They get money for that.
I guess it's a bit of a kick in the teeth. But I mean, I believe in like trade between different countries, and I don't believe in Brexit. So I'm not like in favour of not trading with other countries.
I think it's just dirty business of Saudi sheikhs, like let's say this, and it can be related some money laundry or something like that. In my opinion, I think this, and as you know, that the papers, Pandora Papers, is maybe it's just related each other's.
I sort of don't particularly like the fact that all the Premiership football clubs are owned now, you know, by people who seem to run them for profit rather than, you know, sort of the true fan base. So slightly disapproving view from that point of view. Obviously, from what you were touching on, their human rights record, that rings alarm bells as well. So overall, not a fan, like, you know, I guess.
I mean, as long as it keeps the clubs running, I guess. That's quite good, I think. I'm not a pro, to be fair. Yeah, I think that could be great.
Deep down, I'm not really bothered, but it shouldn't be them, you know, because they're taking over. Not in a bad way, I don't mean in a bad way, But it shows you money talks. It's all about money. He sold it for 300,000, 300 million, and look how much they're going to invest. But the fans want it, you know, and that's it. It shows you at Crystal Palace with the banner, all the things they've done. They've highlighted it, didn't they? You know, that's it, really. I mean, I don't know what else. What else do you want to know?
Football commentator Gary Neville has argued that Saudi Arabia's ownership of a British football club means that they're more likely to listen to human rights concerns and that this could lead to an improvement in their human rights record. Does the public agree?
There's too much money in football to think that people would discover a conscience.
Not actually, because it's different things, yeah. But it can be some illegal things, I believe, because it's not easy to prove the source of money.
I mean, I'm not sure. I'm not really sure. Because obviously my life is completely different from these people who are able to financially buy a football club. So I wouldn't... It's not the same life, I would say.
I don't know. Their human rights is bad. So at the end of the day, I'm not the one who makes the decision. You know, the FA should know better and the Premier should know better. But they must have went through it, didn't they? You know, the Premier should have allowed it, you know. But they don't really care either. Brings money into the Premiership, doesn't it?
I think you have to respect Gary Neville, who knows his football. I think sport has can have an impact on politics and for the good, but it's a bit of a tall order, isn't it?
I mean, I think it's wishful thinking. I don't think they're going to change the way that they treat people in that country because they bought Newcastle United. I don't see that happening.
I don't think it's going to make a difference. I mean, this is like a bit of fun for them, a bit of petty cash, I don't think. Buying a football team here is going to make any difference to human rights in Saudi Arabia.
I think the FA should have made a private inquiry about the takeover as well, the background of it, really. But it's sad that not many English owning football clubs around the Premier League. And I think the FA should act upon it. And I think Phil Neville honestly should keep his comment to himself.
Well, who knows? Saudi Arabia is bad. It's, I don't know. We're just people talk. Says that bad, good. I don't think so. That is a businessman who buy that. It's not about good country or not.
No, I wouldn't follow that school of thought. I like Gary Neville, and he's quite funny, but no, I don't think I would agree with him on that.
Completely different thing. I mean, it's the same with in many different countries where you hope that having some influence over human rights for being investing in that country or developing that country, but actually it doesn't work out like that. Yeah, no, I don't believe that argument.
On first thought, no. I think that seems a little bit optimistic. I think that the fact that they've bought a club, frankly, won't make a difference to that.
A quick look at the financial statistics tells the story. The Newcastle United deal cost its new Saudi owners £305 million. However, the money invested in just the players in Manchester City is estimated at over £1 billion. It's also estimated that 13 football clubs out of 20 in the Premier League are now wholly or mainly foreign-owned. The net worth of the Newcastle United owners is put at $250 billion. In recent years, we've seen Saudi Arabia host British elite boxing matches, and now they've purchased a British football club. What, in the public's opinion, is behind Saudi Arabia's sudden interest in British sports?
Well, I think it goes back to, like, you know, it's about the reputation. If they can get these massive fights, the whole world's watching. So, you know, if they can get AJ, Usyk, Fury, it just seems like that's the place to be. There's some kind of, you know, reputation, some standard there, which obviously there isn't, but that's what the money's buying, and it's a shame these sportsmen are going off and buying into it. So I think that's the main thing, it's a spectacle, getting an audience, a viewership there, making it seem like, you know, it's a place to be, but it's just money and it comes back to money.
I guess if I had to say something off the top of my head, it's like I said earlier, where sport is a very big part of what we do. I mean, I live in Highbury and Islington. I've lived here all my life, and I've watched like Arsenal matches and people streaming out of thousands and thousands of people, you know, streaming out of Highbury Islington Station, walking down Highbury Fields to go see a sports match. And so if you think about it, the perhaps reach that you could get by affecting sports matches is pretty big.
I guess England has always, and Great Britain, because we're such an old nation, we have a lot of history here. And I definitely feel that a lot of countries like to buy in to the things that we have here in Great Britain because of like our ancient theatre, our ancient sport, architecture, all that sort of stuff. So I feel like Saudi Arabia and other countries do like to invest in Great Britain. It makes them feel like maybe that they have more of a historical background or backing behind them. Whereas in, if you're a relatively new country, development-wise, you sort of don't have that richness that we have here, I think, in more of a cultural aspect of richness, not as in like actual richness.
I do believe it's a business warfare. It's nothing to do with military. I think it's they're competing each other in the Middle East in terms of wealth and enterprises and business. I think they're trying to buy out clubs. Qatar bought PSG, United Arab Emirates bought Man City, and now you've got Suburb bought Newcastle. And I just feel like they're trying to buy clubs to compete each other and other businesses just to compete. If they don't get on the war field, they probably get on the business terms.
Well, I suppose Saudi Arabia has always had connections with English sport. I mean, they're very, very connected with English racing. And I'm is Sheikh Makhtoum, is he from Saudi Arabia? I can't remember. Anyway, no. I can't think that there's anything more than the kudos of owning a Premier League football club. It's the best in the world.
I think it gives a element of legitimacy to them so that they get their foot through the door for other stuff. And I think if you look at football generally, it's quite a corrupt organisation, the way that it works from grassroots all the way up to the Premier League. You know, you look at the way Qatar got the World Cup and what's happened there. It's pretty despicable, to be perfectly honest. Right.
I'm an Arsenal fan, so... You know what I mean? You know, so I've got the Americans here. And do they care? No. You know? But they've got the money, innit? Do what they want. You know, money talks. Trust me. If Viola was... No, I don't know. I work for these lot, don't I? So I don't know.
The Premier League has allowed Middle Eastern dictatorships to purchase Manchester City Football Club and now Newcastle United Football Club. Why would they allow this to happen? And what is the Premier League getting out of these arrangements?
I guess it's about who has the money to buy something, really. I guess it's not about where you're from. It's just about what I couldn't buy a football club, for example. Maybe somebody else can buy a football club. Maybe they've got more to give to that, just because you're from somewhere else. I mean, I don't see the problem. I guess I don't see the problem. Like, is it because people here wanted to buy the football club, but then it's priced at a higher price, so it's been sold overseas to somebody who can afford more? Is that the problem?
The first thing that comes to mind would be money. You know, often a lot of these clubs and whatnot are quite greedy when it comes to money, and especially the people that have lots of money tend to want more money. And I feel like I can't see any other incentive other than just for the cash. that would be my opinion on that, yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? I've got to be honest here. Saudi Arabia, they could come in and buy Newcastle, but they ain't going to take money. You can buy all the best players in the world. Doesn't mean they're going to click. They could buy them next week. Are they going to click? Your manager's going to come in. He might not do well. 6 months down the road, sack him, we get someone else. They could be pear-shaped. Look at Arsenal. Since Arsenal Wenger's left, right, they ain't sorted themselves out. Still struggling, you know, week in, week out. I'm a sad person because I'm an Arsenal fan. But money wouldn't help it, and I think they know that as well. They could pump in so much money into the club if they wanted to, but it's not going to do nothing. You know, you could buy all you want. It doesn't mean nothing. They could go next week in January sales and buy this player, that player, and that player. They might not click, and you know, and the fans would turn on them. You know, turn on them again. You know, and they could walk out any time they want.
Injection of cash, of course, but how it will last, heaven knows, and. I mean, they had a tough enough run with, what was he called, the man who owned Sport Direct? Anyway, so they had a tough time with him. I mean, I think they're a very loyal fan base. They're called the Magpies, I think, aren't they? So good luck, but I'd keep a very open mind on this.
Things have been pretty hopeless for a lot of these clubs, haven't they? You know, and I could see from the way that the Newcastle fans were celebrating that they're excited about it, and you know, somebody's putting a lot of money into their club, and it'll lift them and raise their stakes in the Premiership and make life more interesting. But you know, there's another side to it as well, isn't there? So,
That is what Newcastle wants, right? Newcastle wants to be a powerhouse again, and that's what it will become. You know, it won't be this season. They might get relegated this season, but they will build, and they will become like a. You know, they'll get a conversation at the table like Man City have.
I think it's very strict. It's not very strict for this kind of issues because they have to put some restrictions. For example, they can ask the source of money. And actually, I don't like the... English Football Association's acts for this kind of issues.
I just think it's terms of general revenue, innit? And the Middle East is very big on the Premier League, especially the world and globally as well. And if you cut off ties with a country due to the political reasons, they're going to cut off the funding and sponsorship, really. And I think FA, they're trying to allow that to happen, really. And I think they're there for the money.
The most recent takeover in the Premier League of Newcastle United comes after the controversial go-ahead was given for a consortium led by Saudi Arabia's State Sovereign Wealth Fund, known as the Public Investment Fund, or PIF, to take control of Newcastle United in this £300 million deal. Middle Eastern dictatorships have the money to invest vast sums on English football clubs. But with poor human rights records, this has created a dilemma that can't be resolved by simply pointing at Premier League success. However, it seems that according to the Premier League's ownership rules, when it comes to winning on investment or winning on human rights, the investment always comes first.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters. 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iransat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.